Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I'll tell you this. It's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen. Okay, it's going to be quite extraordinarily different. And all I can say is strap in. His first term's ending with action, and his second term's going to start with a bang. That we can guarantee you. This is going to be a historic day. Starting tomorrow, it's going to be wild. It's like 2 days. You're going to be part of history. We want as many people to get here as possible. We are hurtling towards a constitutional crisis that is going to make the impeachment look like a Sunday picnic. It's going to be complicated, and it's going to be nasty. Live from our nation's capital, you're in the field headquarters of one of the small divisions of the bloodless coup. People are getting revved up. People are getting fired up. People are getting madder, as they should.
The week before the January 6th, 2021 attack on the United States Congress, Steve Bannon talked about war. Bannon is Donald Trump's former advisor. His show and podcast are called The War Room. On January 2nd, 2021, 4 days before the attack, Bannon compared stopping the coming electoral count to the fall of the Roman Republic. "We're at that moment," he said. "That's what this week is." On January 4th, Bannon proclaimed to his listeners that January 6th was, quote, "going to be the day. We're all going to converge and impose our will. You have to impose your will on the opposition." On January 5th, the day before the ransacking of Congress, Bannon said, quote, "We're going to go through a couple of three very turbulent 24-hour periods." He told his audience, "You are not the Greek chorus. You are an active part of this. We are on the cusp of victory. Strap in, the War Room posse. Tomorrow, it's game day." This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Steve Bannon never explicitly said, "Go smash down the doors of the Capitol and parade around the halls of Congress with a Confederate flag while your paramilitary pals hunt for representatives to bind up with zip ties." Because he didn't have to. He set the stage. He flooded the zone. He made radical distrust of elections and a willingness to overthrow government by any means normal for his audience. And that was before January 6th, 2021. So what's Steve Bannon saying now? What's he saying to his millions of listeners? Now, Apple doesn't release specific podcast numbers, but Bannon's War Room podcast often appears among Apple's most popular. Bannon himself claims that he had more than 30 million downloads by early 2021. And he's not the only one. Radio has always been a culturally and politically influential medium in this country, particularly on the far right.
Get ready to hear the truth about America on a show that's not immune to the facts with your host, Dan Bongino.
People won't accept being lied to. They won't. So there's a great fracture coming, and you're living through it right now.
Dan Bongino is the fourth most listened to host in the country. His podcast has ranked number one on iTunes. There are also many others: Stu Peters, Mark Levin, Eric Erickson, Charlie Kirk. The list goes on. There's a constellation of far-right political podcasters who are using the decentralized medium to reach more people than ever. So what are they saying now? And can it give us some insight into what listeners might be willing to believe and do in the future? Well, Tim Miller is writer-at-large at The Bulwark and hosts a show on Snapchat called Not My Party. And he spent the week of the anniversary of the January 6th insurrection, so just a couple of weeks ago, listening for 3 hours a day, every day, to Steve Bannon's show. And he wrote a story about it at The Bulwark, and we've got a link at onpointradio.org. Tim Miller, welcome.
Hey, Meghna.
So first of all, we're already getting comments on our social media of folks who say, "Hey, I listen to both On Point." And someone says, "I love Dan Bongino." This is Risha. Says, "I love Dan Bongino, Candace Owens, etc. Open up your minds." Ken Kushler says, "I listen to both." So I want to just first of all acknowledge up front that no one person or rarely, exclusively listens to one or the other. There's quite a bit of diversity and overlap in terms of what people listen to. So I am not here to excoriate listeners. What I'm hoping to do with you, Tim, is understand what the likes of Bannon, Bongino, et cetera, are saying and how what they're saying and how who they're reaching is sort of changing Americans' beliefs in their own government and their own system of democracy. So, listeners, I want you to know that. We're not here to vilify you, but examine folks like Bannon. So give me a quick roundup, Tim, of what you heard Bannon say the week of January 6th this year.
Well, look, I'm encouraged that there are some people that listen to both, Meghna. I think this is a big, important part of this exercise, right, that there are these bubbles, these information bubbles in this country, that there are certain people that are living exclusively in them, right? And I think it's important to examine what is happening, you know, outside of your bubble. And I think that had more people in the period between November and January been listening and taking seriously the the comments from people like Bannon, I think that we would have been better prepared for what was going to happen on January 6th. And I don't want to make that mistake again. And right. And my biggest takeaway from spending 16 hours with Steve Bannon recently was that I wasn't even exactly sure that the tape that you played in the intro from January 5th, 2021, whether that was the clip from before the insurrection or whether that was a clip from recently. And that is how unchanged the tone is from his show. That is how unchanged the fact that Joe Biden was inaugurated has made his show and others in this universe. And I would sort of separate the avowedly insurrectionist, alternate universe description of what happened in the 2020 election and what should happen in the 2024 election, which is a call to arms to ensure that this never happens again, mm-hmm. that this being the Democrats are allowed to win an election. I would separate that, which happens on Bannon's and Bongino's show, from some of the other conservative talk radio, right? I think that there is an explicitly pernicious strain that emanates from Bannon and a handful of others that is a religious crusade that is calling people to ensure that Donald Trump and his minions are in power forever and to delegitimize anyone who claims otherwise.
Yeah.
And I think that strain led to January 6th.
So that's a very important distinction right now, because we don't want to use the same brush to paint everything right of center, whatever that is. I'm not even sure how to describe it anymore. But so I appreciate that nuance there. Let's listen to a little bit of what you heard, Tim, of what Steve Bannon said just... 13 days ago on his show, The War Room. So this is January 6, 2022, the anniversary of the attack on the Capitol.
The numbers are coming our way. You know why? We've got this little platform. What do you got? You got all the tech oligarchs, you got all the media, you got everything. Right now, 40% of the American people, and that's including Democrats, believe he's illegitimate. Over 50% of independents believe he's illegitimate. Let me give it to you with both barrels. Trump won. Biden's illegitimate. And here's the thing. We want you to talk about January 6th every day. Keep talking about it. All the polling showing people want to know about the economy. They want to know about jobs. They want to know about your hapless handling of COVID-19. We want to know about Buttigieg and why and around the capital city. You can't travel, right? 6 inches of snow shuts this thing down. You've ruined Christmas. You got no supply chain. That's what they want to know about their jobs, their family, the southern border, okay? But we want you to keep, the more you talk about 6th January, the more you talk about it, and you talk about how you stole and you're so smug about how you stole 3 November. Did I repeat myself? Trump won, okay? And Biden's illegitimate, and you're just going to have to live with it, okay? Because we're not backing off one inch, and we're winning. We're ascendant.
That's Steve Bannon on his show and podcast, The War Room, 13 days ago on January 6, 2022. Tim Miller, what were some of the other hallmarks of what you heard that week?
Look, I think that the big hallmark, right, is just the repetition of that very message, right? And I think that if you listen to a clip like that, right, yeah, you can sense he's roguish. You know, he's having a little bit of fun with this. But if you are the type of person who is tuning in 3 hours a day every day, and you keep being told, that the current president is illegitimate, that the result has been a catastrophe, that they are stealing Christmas from you, you know, that your life, you know, the way of life that you, you know, have been used to in your community, that you value, your religious life, you know, that is under attack. You know, eventually people keep listening to that over and over again, and they start to take that seriously. You know, what is the next step when you are told that the current regime is illegitimate, they stole things from you, and that all of the things that you're aggrieved about is their fault, and it shouldn't be this way? You know, if things were fair, it wouldn't be this way if it wasn't for the oligarchs and if it wasn't for this illegitimate regime. Eventually that is going to radicalize people and spur them into action. And you know, there was one line from that same January 6th show. You know, he brought in a rabbi to do a prayer. He brought in a priest. And, you know, they talk about, let us not be so timid in our fight against our enemies. You know, again, it is this religious, you know, iconography over Biden's shoulder, or excuse me, over Bannon's shoulder. You see, you know, Jesus and Mary and his little red getter hat. And you know, he repeatedly calls people and spurs them to action. But you know, there are other topics as well, but this is the main topic of the show.
So the constant repetition there. But let me ask you, though, Tim, how is this different from, you know, what other very popular radio personalities did for years? I mean, I'm thinking, sure. I mean, Rush Limbaugh being the godfather of them all, the late Rush Limbaugh. I mean, I know tons of people who listen to Rush every day and sort of just enjoyed the bloviating, but didn't necessarily you know, succumb to the brainwashing possibilities of the rhetoric.
Yeah, well, I think there are two things that are different. You know, one is that obviously it's not as if I'm going to sit on here and tell you that Rush Limbaugh never lied. Rush Limbaugh lied from time to time, but it was these sort of normal lies that are within the you know, discourse, you know, the exaggerations, right? And the people who are listening to Rush also listened to Tom Brokaw at night. I was encouraged that some also listened to the show. But these days, I think that there is a closed ecosystem that is completely disconnected from reality. And that's different than hyperbole.
Okay, so we're going to talk more and learn more about what that closed ecosystem is on the other side of this break. So Tim Miller from The Bulwark, standby. We're talking about far-right podcasters, really, and what they're saying now and what it means people might believe in the future. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about what Steve Bannon and Charlie Kirk and Dan Bongino and a whole constellation of highly listened to and highly influential right-wing broadcasters and podcasters are saying right now, and what that might mean their listeners will believe or possibly even do in the future. I'm joined by Tim Miller. He's writer-at-large at The Bulwark, and he spent the week of January 6, 2022 listening to every piece of audio that Steve Bannon put out. And so we're here to learn what Tim Miller learned. But let's touch on some of the other big names here in this constellation. One of them is Charlie Kirk. And on January 6, 2022, the one-year anniversary of the attack on Congress, Kirk had Julie Kelly on his show to talk about her new book, January 6th, how Democrats are using the Capitol protest to launch a domestic war on terror against the political right.
Was January 6th a terror attack?
Oh, by no means was it a terror attack. We know what this FBI is capable of, right? This case is unraveling for the government. It is exposing the FBI's central role in concocting that plot, luring men into that plot, organizing all of the optics about that, and then setting these men up to buy explosives from an undercover FBI agent.
It's from Charlie Kirk's show earlier this month. And here's Dan Bongino, one of the most popular radio personalities in the country. You're going to hear him get across a bunch of ideas in less than 30 seconds.
There's a great fracture coming, and you're living through it right now. You're seeing the left and their media acolytes, these kissing acolytes, kind of create an alternate reality that doesn't exist, that defies the facts on the ground. And then you're seeing us as we accept the real world. And what's happening is you're seeing this insane, like, extinction burst of behavior on the left in the media, where despite creating an alternate reality, that despite doing that, they accuse us of what they're doing.
That's a moment from Dan Bongino's show, a recent broadcast there. Tim Miller, there's a lot of almost sort of they are accusing whoever they are, accusing us of what they're doing talk in the podcast that we've listened to over the past, you know, few days. How common is that?
Very. Look, there's a lot of projection, right? You know, there are very often times where, you know, they're making accusations. You know, one that jumps to mind on from the Bannon podcast is they had a gentleman who Robert Malone, who was also on Joe Rogan's podcast, which is even bigger than Bannon's, talking about this theory called mass formation psychosis. And it's the idea that the entire country has, you know, become, you know, been brainwashed essentially into believing that COVID is something that it's not. And when that is exactly what they're doing, right, on these shows, which is advancing a, you know, upside down psychosis where COVID is not the thing that is causing the death, but it's vaccines. On Bannon's podcast, they had a gentleman come on who wrongly, obviously, stated that hundreds of thousands of deaths have resulted from the vaccines. They wrongly state that Trump won the election, of course, when he lost. But in order, I think, to kind of give this comfort food to, you know, the listeners who are not just there for the show, right? Some listeners are there for the show, but in order to give the comfort food for the true believers, the real listeners, they need to, you know, project to say it is the other side that is spreading the disinformation and you can only trust us. Only valuable information can come from us. This is a power that Trump had as well, you know, that you can only trust the presidential Twitter feed, that makes his kind of propaganda and agitprop a category difference, you know, from the standard fare that we've seen recently in the American past, their foreign comparisons. Mm.
Well, so here is Dan Bongino doing what you just described, Tim, regarding fomenting more distrust in any media other than basically himself.
The New York Times, and what has to be the, I mean, huge balls moment of the month. The New York Times and the Brookings Institution, the PP paper, the PP hoax paper, and the Dossier Institution combining to tell us what misinformation is. That's a classic. That's an instant classic. This really happened. Not a joke. All right, folks, when it comes to healthcare, it's important to make sure you're getting your money's worth. Crowd Health offers a more flexible and affordable healthcare option without the hassle of insurance.
And then we got an ad, obviously, right at the tail end of that. Tim, give me a sense as to, you know, we can talk about this in the abstract. I've used the word influence several times here. But
sure.
Can we put some hard numbers on it? Regarding podcast downloads, it's tough, right? Because Apple isn't putting out those numbers. So how do we describe their influence and reach of these podcasts in particular?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to answer that. I want to make one additional distinction very briefly about, look, distrust of the media on the right, this goes back to Spiro Agnew
forever,
and probably before,
yeah.
Right? Here's the difference is, again, in that time, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, there were still only so many options, right? You still had to read your local paper. You still saw your local news at night, right? So different information sources were getting in. If you're listening to Bongino and Bannon and watching Tucker at night, you know, that's 7 hours of content a day right there. You're not, you know, no other information is breaking in. So I think this is important. If you look at the numbers, just at the podcast, right? Bongino and Bannon are always in the top 10. You know, they're right next to the NPR morning podcast at the top of the list for a sense of how big their audience is. But it's not just also podcasts. I mean, Bannon's show, for example, is streaming on Apple TV and Roku and The Dish. Bongino has, you know, over-the-air radio, which is 6 times bigger than podcasts and markets all across the country. So, you know, Bannon claims, you said there were 30 million at the start. Now they're claiming up to 100 million. You know, who knows? This is probably some exaggeration. But I think there's no doubt if you look at objective metrics that, you know, this is, you know, these are the most listened to shows, you know, on the equivalent with the big shows on the left, The Daily, Pod Save America, you know, things of that, mm-hmm. Rachel Maddow.
Mm. Well, let's listen to a little bit more here. This is the Clay Travis and Buck Sexton show last week, flipping the narrative on the considerable battles we've seen across the country about mask mandates and vaccines.
You're mad because you took something that doesn't work. You don't get to lock down the rest of the country. It is distinctly un-American at this point. Can everyone say at this point, when there are 12 deaths across the globe, it's the sniffles?
Absolutely. Can we just stop calling it a vaccine, though? I really want us to start calling
it.
It's a drug. It really is.
You're absolutely right.
It's a treatment. We talked about this before the show. Like, if the United States government came out and mandated that you took a drug that didn't cure you, didn't keep you from getting sick, and doesn't keep you from spreading it, would you have done it?
It's a placebo.
That's why they changed the definition of the word vaccine. It is a drug. So you are mad at people who are undrugged. That's it.
So that's from last week in the Clay Travis and Buck Sexton show. Obviously, COVID mandates, vaccination are going to be and have been immense fodder for everybody because it's the biggest story we're all living through. But there are other ones as well, Tim. I can't remember if you just mentioned, you talked about the claims of mass psychosis, but replacement theory also comes up a lot. With this constellation of podcasters and media personalities, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. I think that the border and the replacement theory, the fact that, you know, sort of the white majority is disappearing is something that comes up a lot. To the Clay Travis clip, I also wrote for The Bulwark last year a lengthy Clay Travis profile that you can see. And this has been maybe it's a competitive category, but maybe the wrongest man over the course of the pandemic. Throughout the entire time, he said, oh, you know, there'll only be 1,000 deaths, only be 5,000. You know, now we're approaching 1 million deaths, and he's still spreading the same misinformation. And this is where it gets sad, right? I think that there's a sense sometimes to consider these guys entertainers and to minimize it. But when you think about the actual impact, I mean, on Bannon Show 2 weeks ago, they literally had a guest who was on an oxygen tank zooming in, you know, to talk about Antifa or something else. And in the same breath that, you know, they were claiming that the vaccine was the one that was causing the deaths. Who knows about the health of that person. But there are people who are listening to these shows who are making very dangerous decisions for their own health. For no reason other than to support these entertainers. And I think that is where you see, you know, this meeting real life, people's decisions on the vaccines, as well as obviously their actions in January 6th.
Well, we actually have a moment from what you just referenced. Bannon talks about one of his, quote, correspondents who was hospitalized in the hospital for COVID and on oxygen. And here's how that played out on his show.
I'm praying. Thank you, Lord. My angels are with me. I absolutely know it. God wins, but the Democrats have to be held accountable. China has to be held accountable. Antifa and BLM, who terrorized our country for 4 years, have to be held accountable. Where's BLM? Where are Antifa? Where are they now? They were simply used by the Democrats to steal the election, to intimidate judges, to intimidate politicians, and to intimidate the American people to shut up and sit down. That's why we still have people in Guantanamo, D.C., being terrorized right now, tortured right now. They don't care about the actual truth. They don't care about fixing the country.
So that's one of Steve Bannon's correspondents in the hospital on oxygen, but also on Steve Bannon's show. Now, I want to play another clip from Dan Bongino. Again, a really big name in radio and podcasting. This is from last September when Bongino spent quite a bit of time reading from an article by Thomas D. Klingenstein about a call to arms.
Are we already in a cold civil war with the left? And if we are, why haven't many on the right woken up to that fact? Now, I don't think that's many in my audience who've been woken up to this a long time ago, but there are many in the D.C. swamp who still believe that the left views us as just people with bad ideas. They don't. They view us as bad people with ideas. They don't care what your ideas are. They see you as bad people. That is important. You must understand the distinction. Folks, first the step is recognizing that we are in a cold civil war. It is zero sum. Does everybody understand that? Because we believe in things like liberty, free and fair elections, judging people by their character, not their skin color or their religion. The left does not believe that. Here, getting back to the piece, from this American Greatness piece. He says, winning this cold civil war requires two fundamental understandings. First, you must understand that you are, in fact, in a war. Wartime requires very different rhetoric, strategy, and people than peacetime. Trump is a wartime leader. Second, you must understand your enemy, what it wants, and how it goes about getting what it wants. What our enemy wants is the destruction of the American way of life. It goes about it by trying to force everyone to say America is systemically racist.
That's Dan Bongino from last September. Now, we are playing extended clips, usually longer clips than we usually would, to give you the full context of, you know, sort of how these thoughts and ideas unfold over the course of several minutes in any one of these podcasts. But Tim, can you just stand by here with us for a second? Because I want to introduce now Cynthia Miller Idris. She's a professor of law and criminology at American University and director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab, also author of Hate in the Homeland, the New Global Far Right. Professor Miller Idris, welcome to you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So, you know, doubt about government, conspiracy theories, militias, bloviating personalities, carnival barkers, all of these things are as American as apple pie, and they've been with us for centuries. Is what we're hearing now from these podcasts, for example, from what Tim listened to for a week with Steve Bannon, is it any different than it was before?
It is a little bit different right now. I mean, there are a couple different ways in which the disinformation ecosystem, I think I would call it, is changing. And one is just the sheer, as Tim was just saying, you know, the sheer volume of it and the broad breadth of places that you can go to listen to it and to encounter it. But the other thing is that because of how much of our time we spend in online contexts and the way that disinformation or propaganda or salacious content kind of finds you through algorithms or through pockets of things like online gaming or YouTube channels about, hobbies where somebody's inserted information into something, you're just much more likely within a couple of clicks in your daily life to encounter disinformation that can lead you down an ever-expanding series of rabbit holes into different dedicated podcasts or shows or whatever it is. And so it used to be much more of a destination that you had to seek out. You had to look for, sign up for a newsletter or subscribe to something or join a group. And I think it's just much more likely today that people encounter it when they're already have already sort of been seeded to distrust media and facts and science and knowledge through the introduction of things like alternative facts and all the other kinds of undermining that we've seen over the past few years.
So this echoes a point that Tim was making a little earlier, that due to the vast difference in the overall media landscape and technology as well, to put it simply, Professor Miller Idris, are you saying that it's hard, it's much harder now than it ever was to stop the walls from growing around you, no matter what you do?
I think it's much harder now to avoid encountering disinformation. Okay. I think it's just much more likely that you're going to encounter it. But people don't have kind of the built-in resilience because they're used to listening to expertise or things that they hear in a media landscape and thinking that they can trust it. And because that's when there used to be more curated forms of news and information coming to us. It kind of, it had to be vetted and sourced. There was source integrity, and you could turn on the television to one of your three channels and kind of, you know, count on there being some journalistic, you know, fact checking. This is much more a landscape of opinion, of disinformation, of sweeping generalizations that are not rooted in fact, and that often are done just to get clicks, just to draw attention, and in really dangerous ways, I think. And people don't trust the sources and don't know how to distinguish. You know, there's a very low level of media and digital literacy here.
Because the pace of change has been quicker than we've been able to keep up with, I would say. So, but you also, you say that there's sort of, there are key features to whether it's a concerted or even sort of decentralized disinformation campaign. What, and do you see those key features in the kinds of podcasts that we've been talking about today?
Yeah, I think some of the what I would point to as really dangerous trends or the kinds of things that can lead to greater mobilization. One that came up again and again in those clips is the us versus them thinking and the kind of positioning of the other, not just as opposed to me in their opinions, but actually as an existential threat. And that is, we're seeing that very clearly in a lot of these clips, like you're in danger, your way of life is in danger, your future is in danger because of these other people. And therefore that poses a threat that you have to kind of rise up against and heroically engage. And we saw that on January 6th very clearly in the kind of post-insurrection interviews when people actually seemed to think that they were being courageous revolutionary actors who are saving democracy.
Well, Cynthia Miller Idris and Tim Miller, hang on here for a second. We'll talk a lot more about the impact of this unhealthy information ecosystem that we're talking about in a moment. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a little peek into what we're going to be talking about tomorrow. We're going to be talking about schools and their struggle to stay open during this big Omicron surge. The Biden administration has promised 10 million monthly COVID rapid tests to schools across the country. But is more testing actually the answer? So we want to hear from you. If you're a parent or teacher whose district relies on widespread testing, is it working? Is it helping to keep the school open? Or are the quarantining protocols that come after a positive test actually a source of greater disruption? We definitely want to hear how the reality is on the ground for schools across the country. So leave us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow. Today, we are talking about the constellation of far-right wing media personalities, really in podcasting and digital media, including Steve Bannon, and the influence they have and what they're saying now to their listeners, and whether or not we can discern anything about what that means those listeners might be willing to believe in the future. And I'm joined today by Tim Miller. He's writer-at-large at The Bulwark. He spent a week listening to Steve Bannon's podcast just a couple of weeks ago on the first anniversary of the attack on Congress. We have a link to the story that he wrote following that at onpointradio.org. And Professor Cynthia Miller Idris joins us as well. She's director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab and a professor at American University as well. Professor Miller Idris, let me just quickly ask you, does it matter whether or not the media folks we've been talking about personally believe what they're saying?
I don't think it does matter. I think that when they speak with conviction, I mean, of course, it matters in some broader way, right? Whether people actually believe it, but in terms of the impact on the audience, if they're persuasive at sharing a conspiracy theory about whether that's about Sandy Hook or about the election, and millions of people believe it, and they're using often these persuasive rhetorical strategies that I was just starting to talk about before, things like being a brave truth teller or telling people to do your own research, or, you know, really kind of manipulative strategies that are identifiable and show up across this ecosystem. So, you know, it doesn't matter so much whether they believe it as much as it matters whether the people who are listening to them believe it and then ultimately sometimes act on it.
Tim Miller, what do you think?
I think that it matters to the extent that they can be compelling, right? I think that there are certain kinds of these shows that, they can't suck you in, right? And I think that you have to know it when you see it. And Bannon, for example, I think there were clear points at which he betrayed that he didn't even believe the BS. For example, when he had the guests on those talking about how the vaccines had killed hundreds of thousands of people, but yet he still had that same guest on the next day. And I think that the key point here is that what he believes is in the mission. He believes that his listeners need to rise up and overthrow the elites. He believes in the idea that there really are domestic enemies in this country that are out to get them. And if you can make that sale, then whether you believe all the particulars don't really matter, because, you know, your audience is just looking for any information that supports the broader mission.
Okay. Well, we're getting a lot of comments from folks here who are online right now. Jacob Evans says, I used to listen to some right-wing talk radio back in the early 2000s, wanted to hear different perspectives. Once 9/11 happened, though, the tone of every show went dramatically darker and more hostile. Ken Kushler says, I listen to both. The problem isn't with most of the ideas of people. It lies within the engineered division, a point Professor Miller Idris that you had been making earlier. Christopher Kelly, though, says, I occasionally tune into Hannity, Mark Levin, Glenn Beck, Bill Cunningham. These guys are textbook ideologues. In other words, they might be characterized in some forms as cognitively disadvantaged. But Professor Miller Idris, let me ask you about the ideologue part. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, there are a couple of different things I think that are really important. One, yes, we're seeing this absolute division, the us versus them kind of thinking. We're seeing, I think your listener who dates this back to post 9/11 is right. Although I would say just a few years later than that is when we really saw, just after Obama was elected, the serious uptick that was coincided right around the time that social media kind of burst on the scene and really coincided with both a record-breaking number of hate groups in the country and the emergence of new kind of unlawful militias like the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters who peppered the universe with this idea of freedom and tyranny and fighting for liberty. And that kind of rolled into a whole broad range of new ways to communicate about those ideas. And so I think, you know, the ideologies are there, but there's a lot of emotional underpinning around resistance, rebellion, around a sense of belonging and this call to heroic action. And those things kind of, you know, the ideology almost comes after those emotional underpinnings, I think, that draw people in.
Hmm. So I really want to get a better sense as to why this matters. I mean, to me, part of it is clearly obvious. There was an attack on Congress a year ago, right? An attack by Americans on their own government. So that is evidence right there of why I think this matters. But deeper than that as well, and Professor Miller Idris, I'm going to start with you, and then Tim, I'll ask you the same thing. What are the most important factors in pushing someone towards extremist thought. I mean, you call it radicalization in a recent op-ed you wrote. But what are the most important factors? And are these types of podcasts, this kind of information, part of those factors?
Yeah, generally the biggest and most important thing that has to happen for people to become willing to use violence and mobilize to use violence for political or ideological reasons is that they come to see the world as divided into very clear and bounded us versus them categories in which the other group poses an existential threat to you, your family, your way of life, or your future. And so to the extent that that kind of dynamic underpins a lot of this and just further fuels this idea that they are out to get you, that it's an existential thing, meaning whether that's because of demographic change, so we get back to the border and the idea of a great replacement or invasions, or it's that Second Amendment rights are going to be taken away from you, or that an election was stolen from you, or whatever it is that is posing an existential danger and you have to rise up. That, I think, is where you get the underpinnings of real serious potential for a fringe among that. Certainly not all the people who believe that, but for fringe actors, more and more of them to believe that they have to act heroically and really stand up for their people or their movement or their freedoms or whatever it is, their rights. And that's where you end up with both lone actor violence and then, in this case of January 6th, spontaneous violence on the, along with some planned violence for a small minority of people, but real spontaneous violence by thousands of people who might not have actually planned to be violent on that day.
Mm. What's troubling in addition to that is that the willingness or people's stated willingness to use violence in this country for political means is rising. But not
absolutely.
not just on the right, though. I mean, I think I've seen polling that says it's rising on the left as well. But let's listen to a moment from Steve Bannon's show. This is on January 6th of this year, where he spoke with Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene.
What are you going to do to lead this country, to turn it back around and to go forward?
Steve, I see things maybe a little differently, and I don't want to alarm anyone. I think that our country is already gone. I think we're post-Constitution, and I think China is absolutely ahead of us.
Tim Miller, that existential threat line, did you hear that a lot in your listening?
Did apocalyptic, right? Yeah. The country's already gone. A lot of folks say we're losing it. We're on the brink of the country being gone. It was the old Flight 93 argument, before the 2016 election. We need to charge the cockpit to save the country that was made by Trump supporters. I think Marjorie was a little bit more of a blunt force instrument saying it's already gone. We're post-Constitution. They're saying out loud, right? I think this is like to your previous question about why this matters. Key figures within the Republican Party are saying out loud that as a result of the fact that the country's already gone, we need to eschew some of our traditional constitutional norms. And maybe we could have, as Bannon said in an earlier clip, a bloodless coup. You know, maybe we need to just take power and assert power that goes beyond the rule of law. People are saying that on this show, and I think that the important part about listening to this and understanding it is why there's kind of this responsible type of Republican that you hear a lot from on, mainstream media sources. The ones who might play a little footsie with the fact that the election was stolen by, saying that they didn't like the way that mail-in ballot voting or whatever was working. There is this underbelly that truly wants a post-constitutional order in which their side takes power and can punish their enemies. And you saw that underbelly in action just this week in Arizona, where Donald Trump held a rally speaking to this alternative universe with the leading candidate for Senate and governor in that state alongside him at the rally. And I think sometimes it's hard for people to just kind of carry these two thoughts in their minds that, that the Mitch McConnell types, the types that are in D.C. who they might disagree with politically, are also part and parcel with this broader effort to actually overthrow our democratic system. And to me, that is, the most dangerous part about this and why it's so important that we pay attention to it.
Mm. Professor Miller Idris, to dovetail off what Tim said, I mean, what does your research show about how long the process of adopting extremist or radical thought takes?
Well, there are two different things here that are really interesting. to raise. One is that historically, you know, it would take 18 months to 24 years, I would say, a long, slow radicalization process before you would see an individual usually become mobilized to violence after they'd started to be exposed to kind of real extreme viewpoints about an us versus them way of thinking, et cetera. But that's, the pandemic has really accelerated all of that. And under the pandemic conditions, first of all, we have a much older population now who, you know, even on January 6th, just older than your average person who had been willing to be violent. So they're older, they're consuming more media online, everything is moving faster. And so many people kind of fell down to a rabbit hole of QAnon conspiracy theories, for example, in a matter of weeks, much, much faster. What we don't know is, does that mean they can be brought out of it just as quickly? Because typically, you know, de-radicalization, disengagement also takes years. It takes a long, slow time of people kind of therapeutically engaging with the disconnection that they've made, even from reality. But the other thing I think it's important to say is, you know, as a democracy itself, you know, we were added to a list of backsliding democracies in late 2021 for the first time. And the data show that's globally, you know, it's a big deal. And it's a bit much bigger indication of what's happening in this country in terms of trust in government and voter suppression issues, and et cetera. But the data on that globally shows once a country gets added to a list like that, it takes about 9 years on average before they go one way or the other. Either you get yourself off that list by restoring, you know, democracy, or you collapse as a country. And so I think it's not an immediate, you know, we do have immediate problems on hand, but we also need some longer term interventions to ensure that we start to have, you know, better equipped citizens and residents who are able to distinguish fake news from facts.
Yeah, it seems very challenging in order to build the tools to help equip Americans for that. Because, you know, we, for example, in researching this show, we spoke with an expert in Wisconsin, Lewis Friedland, who's at the Center for Communication and Democracy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And, you know, he talked about the sort of national and local feedback loop for households in Wisconsin. He described a dozen radio stations across the entire state, and that Hannity, Bongino, Joe Rogan, and others in most markets in the state, they were getting 8 to 10 hours a day of that programming. And then there was local talk radio on top of that for several hours a day. So even if you just turn on the radio, this isn't on demand. Entire swaths of the state for you know, 12 hours a day, this is what people were hearing, or is what people were hearing. So Professor Miller, just, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah. Well, two things. One, you know, I think yes, there's absolutely no quick fix. We're in an immediate, we're in an immediate crisis, and the crisis kind of intervention tools, I think, are going to be different than the longer term needs for media and digital literacy and the kinds of things that have to be incorporated into broad public, public education. I will say two things that are optimistic for me. One, we have been testing a lot of different ways to do what's called video-based inoculation, where you teach people about the propaganda tools, the rhetorical strategies, like the brave truth teller, like the scaffolding of conspiracy theories. And for our first year of projects, we found that it all works. And now we just have to figure out how to scale it up. People they can be taught to recognize some of the manipulative tactics. We just have to figure out how to get those kinds of videos and audio tests in front of them. The other thing that gives me hope is, actually, I just started teaching again last week. And I will say, for the first time ever, in just the first class, establishing the kind of ground rules, this young generation does not want any part right now of what the older generation is doing. And so they are establishing rules about respect in the classroom, about ideological diversity, about listening to each other, already 100% beyond where I'd seen previous cohorts of students. I think they are sick of it. And I think that, we do have a group of younger kids coming up who just are really disappointed in their parents' generation, right, and in what everybody else has been doing.
Tim, you've been listening really patiently, and I'm so grateful for that. We got 30 seconds left, and I want to reiterate one thing, and that is, we're not here to vilify the listeners, but I will ruthlessly vilify the lies that are being poured into these listeners' ears. And some of those are coming on these shows, from the very representatives in government, right, that should know better. So in the last few seconds, Tim, I'm going to give you the last thought here. Do you see a pathway for optimism.
Yeah, no, briefly, I used to be a Republican. I'm on the side of these listeners. It is the people that are hosting these shows who have caused some of them to die, to get sick, to go to jail with their lies. And so, look, I think that the way in is to break off the most extreme actors and try to speak to these people in other forums, you know, outside of traditional mediums. And that's the path forward.
Well, Tim Miller, writer-at-large at The Bulwark. We've got a link to his article at onpointradio.org about listening to Steve Bannon for a week. He's also host of a show on Snapchat called Not My Party. Tim, it's been very great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Magna.
And Cynthia Miller Idris, professor of law and criminology at American University and author of Hate in the Homeland, The New Global Far Right. Professor Miller Idris, very good to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.